very warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time. In all the episodes, we shall be discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guest, I should mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom. So if you do hear a few background noises, you'll know why. Helping us in our explorations today is Dr. Isabel Vella-Gregory. Dr. Vella-Gregory is affiliate scholar at the MacDonald Institute for Archaeology, University of Cambridge, and is also deputy director of the Jebel Moya project, which is a large, multi-period mortuary site in Sudan. Maybe we'll have a moment to talk about that. Welcome and thank you, Isabel, if I may, for accepting to come on the program to talk to us about bodies in archaeology and how bodies are a great source of information that goes well beyond skeletal remains. When we first discussed this theme for this episode, we started talking about figurines, but it became clear as we spoke that bodies in general had so many diverse things to say from down the ages. So let's start to talk about bodies. A very straightforward question to start off with. What do bodies tell us?
Thank you so much for having me on this program. And I have to say, the series sounds fascinating. So I'll be following it as well. So yeah, bodies are kind of essential to not just an archaeologist, but to understanding the world, I always say. And so if we start from a very basic level, you know, currently I am excavating in the Sudan, as you said, and it's a mortuary site, so we have plenty of skeletal remains. And so, you know, you can tell things like, are these characteristics belonging to a biological male or female? How old was this person? Was it a child? Was it an adult? And that's sort of by looking at them. And then you can go deeper and you can use bits of the body to find out roughly when they were buried with carbon dating. You can use isotopes, particularly from teeth, because what we eat leaves a signature on our bodies. And so it gives you a broad idea of diet. You can also examine the bones, teeth and legs and whatnot to see the lifestyle. You know, are people eating a lot of hard, starchy foods, which leaves a trace on the teeth and the tooth wear pattern? Do they have well-used knees and ankles? Are they traveling long distances? And in a way, that tells us about the broader environment, how people were living, what they were doing. Were they traveling far, you know, to get their things? But then that's only one part of it, and we can't stop there. Because at the end of the day, we experience and create the world with our bodies. You know, we're not just a set of activities. And so to me, bodies are a gateway into more broader and fascinating questions on what we do with our bodies, how we modify our bodies. Because we all do in some way, whether it's an ear piercing or removing a tooth to put something else in or getting a tattoo to horrify your mother and things like that. People do this a lot. And so for me, that is the main fascination and the starting point. But then there's also the fact that we also create bodies.
Yes, exactly. As you say, skeletal remains tell us so much. But then also we have many other ways of representing bodies. I was interested in your reference to the tattoos. It brought to mind that well-known body that was found, I think, in the tundra somewhere in Russia, where this woman was actually discovered with tattoos all over her body. And that must have been very interesting for the people who found it. There must have been so much they could discover just by looking at the tattoos.
It's funny with bodies, isn't it? Sometimes you hear people grumble, oh, look at the younger generation. They have tattoos or they have these funny earrings and enlarge their earlobes. And in truth, that's a very ancient practice. Ötzi the Iceman had a number of tattoos, possibly maybe associated with healing, because in that case, they were on specific parts like his ankles and things like that. There's the burials in the Altai Mountains where, again, full body tattoos were a thing. I mean, they're widespread in use and meaning across cultures. But also, people, it's not just that, because, you can have tattoos, you can have things like body scarification, where you deliberately make cuts in your body and then pour pigment on it. And these things are not random. Just like today, when you get a tattoo, 99% of the time, it means something to you. It comes with a story. Which leads me to the idea of bodies. And there's, Michel Foucault once said that we inscribe things on our bodies. And that can be read in many ways. Our lifestyle, as we said in the beginning, marks on our bodies, our teeth, our bones, our wear, but also in the way we dress, the way we modify our bodies, the messages we want to communicate, because bodies are so effective at conveying a message. We can look at each other and instantly have an idea of who we are by the way we dress, how we identify. Like, I don't know, when we run into each other and go, oh, those earrings are lovely, or that necklace is lovely. It's a way of communicating.
We've all got a body.
And we've all got a social skin. That's another concept from anthropology, that we have this social skin, that we use that to convey a message about who we are. And in a way, it can tell us what a society considers acceptable, clothes-wise, and sometimes it can tell us when people are being a bit of a rebel. So, if everyone in your community is tattooed and you're not, that tells you something, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Obviously, since we've all got one, I suppose, and we want to show other people bodies, what about when we transpose the physical to the model? In archaeology, are these figures that we see right across the ages, really, are they models in the sense of reflecting the bodies around them? Are they models in the sense of our meaning of model, something that is something to be admired and copied? There are so many types of different body to be seen in archaeology.
I know, and that's why I've always been really interested in this. And I remember reading the archaeologist Lynn Meskel once noted, bodies are interesting because they look like us, but they're not us. Because you've created something. Now, it's worth pointing out that we don't just make images of other people or ourselves. We also make animals, creatures, and I know, I'm going to be talking about figurines, but of course people paint the body on walls, on vases, on a number of things. And for me they're interesting because first you're portraying what you want to portray according to the norms of your society. And I think people often ask the wrong questions about figure. Let me just focus on figurines, because otherwise the topic is perhaps a bit too broad. But I remember when I first saw the Neolithic figurines, I was a child, and this is before the museum was, redone and you could enjoy it like that. But I couldn't walk away. And at first, no one could understand why I was so fascinated by these crude bodies, they called them. And that's because my late uncle used to take me around every museum on the island, and I was a big fan of sort of Baroque paintings. If you grow up in Malta, you probably can't escape that element of Baroque. And my family would say, but why you're looking, you love this art, why are you so fascinated by this? And even though I was young, something told me this isn't just art. And it took me decades to come to terms with that, because of course then you start to study things formally, and suddenly everyone's talking about art, primitive, fertility, all sorts of things. But I study archaeology because I'm interested in people. And so they may not be a portrait of a person. Does something have to be?
I'm thinking of early archaeological finds like cave paintings, which go back thousands of years. There are occasionally lots of bodies painted on the walls, but a lot of also people. So people are always important, aren't they? Even, you know, if you've got 10 buffalo painted on the wall, there's always a guy there, either with a spear or something, or a guy rather than a woman usually.
But also we have this thing of drawing the human form in very different ways. That was the thing that really fascinated me about Maltese figurines. First year at school and everyone talks about fat ladies. And I remember looking at them and thinking, but where's, you know, the anatomy? And you know, I would generally bring this up during Sunday lunch and drive everyone crazy. So there is, and the more I read about it and the more I studied archaeology, the more I was dissatisfied. Because it seemed to me that we were reducing something we didn't understand into this idea of, I don't know, fertility. So then I would ask, okay, what about the children? And no one would talk about that. And we're still reluctant in European archaeology, more broadly, to talk about childhood and motherhood and, you know, all that it entails. And so then when I started really, really looking at Maltese figurines, I realized that what we have in front of us is an entire life cycle. A fascinating, complex story, because figurines have something that Alfred Gell has termed secondary agency. That basically, so as human beings, we have agency to varying degrees. We can choose what we do, but we are always constrained by our societies. Sometimes we break free, sometimes we don't. But sort of societies are created by people and sustained by people. And he pointed out that objects can also have agency if we give it to them, if we make them meaningful. And one example I always use when people struggle with this is holy statues in churches. So if you are devout and you go to pray to Our Lady, whichever version you want to choose, that object there has secondary agency. Someone has imbued it with the power to listen to you, to grant you what you are asking. And, you know, in a way you are talking. It's not just an object. Objects only have agency if we give it to them, which is why we call it secondary agency.
Thinking of figurines in Europe, are there similarities? Are there huge differences? I'm thinking of the Sardinian Nuraghi figures, or compared to other figures. I mean, those are, I think, late Bronze Age, 1300 BC or something like that. But do they change with age? Do they change with situation, geographical situation? How are these figurines diverse or familiar to each other, similar to each other?
This is another thing Lynn Meskel has noted, that they're seductively familiar. They're very seductive figurines. We think we know. But I think the answer is they change according to the people who are making them. So it's funny, if you look at the narratives, when it comes to late Bronze Age, early Iron Age, everyone talks about warriors and whatnot, conveniently forgetting there's a whole corpus of figurines that's not warriors and things like that. If you look at Sardinia, for example, you know, you have musicians, you have women carrying baskets with herbs or whatever. You have a whole diversity. But with figurines, people see what they want to see. Equally with the Paleolithic and the Neolithic, they squish them all in one and say fertility or whatever, forgetting that Paleolithic Europe and Neolithic Malta are completely different. So things like the so-called Venus of Kohlefels from Germany, people are living a particular lifestyle in a very different landscape, in caves that no longer exist or exist in a very modified form. They have a whole set of wildlife and animals that doesn't exist everywhere else. Whereas in Neolithic Malta, you have established farming communities, building big buildings. They're not being chased by woolly mammoths. So it's always struck me as remarkable that people are willing to condense all of that. And of course, it's easy, partly because, as we said, we're looking at bodies and they're seductive and they lead us astray. And it's very easy to go down that path. But also because I think it's a lot of work to have to disentangle each one and figure out the different environments that you're working in.
What are the different materials that have been used in prehistory and early history to create figurines and why?
So in Europe, they use a lot of stone in the Paleolithic, sometimes even stone that comes from a long distance. And I always find it interesting that you get this exotic object, but you shape it into something that is part of your worldview. But in Malta, we moved to the Neolithic. They make images out of clay, out of stone, and even out of bone, which is really, I mean, I've got in mind the tiny, tiny bone figurines from the Shara Circle in Gozo, for example. And they take a tarsal and modify it, and then, you know, so that you can stand it a bit upright. And then someone carefully carved a face, and then carefully applied red and black pigments to give it depth. And the amount of thought that goes into that is really interesting to me.
And what about the artists? We know about Greek artists and sculptors, but what do we know about more ancient artists and sculptors? Who do we think they were? Were they a group apart? Were they just anybody trying their hand? I mean, I know that there are some very sophisticated Neolithic sculptures and some less sophisticated Neolithic sculptures. How do we account for that?
I mean, again, it's got to be, I've always worried about claims of sophistication, possibly because I have an allergy to Roman sculpture, or Greek sculpture, where a lot of these concepts come along, because ultimately it's how you want to represent what you see. Now, with Malta, it's interesting. I don't think there's a simple answer there. What we have, because then we have to look at the corpus in general, and I'll get to that in a moment. But it's clear when you look at it, it's an assemblage. It's coming from a particular point of view. So someone is definitely deciding what that point of view is, and people are accepting, cooperating, and replicating that. You know, the duality of agency, it structures us and we structure it. Who is doing it? It's hard to tell, because the problem, at least with Maltese archaeology, is with prehistory, we've been really focused on so-called temples. Now, there you're going to find the contents, but you're missing a whole lot of life. That's why I found Ruben Grima's work fascinating, because, well, monuments in search of a landscape, you called it, and it's true. And so, you know, we have to try and think about where you would make things. Now, as to who, I think probably the people who make pottery were perfectly capable of making the clay figures. And if you look at them closely, some of the decoration techniques are similar to the ones used for decorating pottery. So there's the same toolkit, the same chain of operation, the same kind of thing going on mentally. I suspect that the stone and bone ones would have been made by others, possibly because carving stone is a very different skill than molding clay or decorating clay. So that was one of the reasons from figurines I meandered to ceramics, because I wanted to understand how they are made, the chain of operations, and the community of practice, because you can't divorce them from the community. So still working on that, and I remain hopeful it will tell us something as well about the making at least of clay figurines there.
Well, I understand your diffidence with regards to the word sophisticated, totally understand it. But I must say that even if I tried, I would never be able to create something like the so-called sleeping lady, not even on my best artistic day. So I meant sophisticated in the sense of talented, I suppose. Not everybody is.
Yeah, but it's an interesting point you raise, because I think people often have this view, not those of us who have studied it, but people have this view of prehistory as being simple and far away. And so in a way, simplistic explanations of fertility resonate because they're uncomplicated. But you recognize, for example, that the so-called sleeping lady, she's sleeping, dreaming, whatever. But the amount, what fascinates me is what led to the making of that figurine. And, you know, you have this lusciously large body with these sort of the proportions, right? The waist in proportion to the hips and the backside. There's this, it's fluid. Almost, there's the sense of being cocooned in something comforting, and all the tiny details down to the bed that she's lying on and the skirt, all things you could convey the message in different ways, but people choose that way. I'm glad you brought that up, because the sleeping lady is kind of, if we look at figurines, right, if we really look at the assemblage, there's such a difference. So we have the so-called Venus of Hajar Inn, for example, a small clay figurine. The head is missing, but we have a woman. You look at her and you think, actually, that could be me. We can identify with that body. You know, she's got the breasts that, you know, possibly droop a little after time. We forget that age is important in a society where we've erased aging in women. You know, we have those curves, the belly, the thighs, anatomically as well, we can identify with her. But then if we move also to Hajar Inn, we have those stone so-called headless figurines, you know, the ones that are found in a group, and they can be seated or standing, and they're large, and they've also been labeled fat ladies, but the interesting thing about them is they're neither male nor female. There is no sense. When people want to represent a woman, they can. When they want to represent masculinity in Malta, we have a series of falli here, and then different shapes and sizes, which again I find really interesting because it means people are aware of different biologies, but these are deliberate. And what's really interesting about them, a detail people often forget, is at the top, we have these little holes, and you can swap heads and put different heads. And what that gives you is the ability to tell many stories. And in a way, you're focused on the story. And once you change the head with different faces, you can convey whatever you want to convey.
When you mentioned, when we were talking off air, we're talking about narrative and storytelling, it's conjured up so many images in my mind, which I hadn't really considered before, I must say.
But you know what's interesting? When we think about it, the so-called temple culture lasts for a very long time. Now, how do you maintain something that resource intensive? You need to have a sense of memory, and you need to give people a sense of you're responsible for taking care of what came before you, so that we preserve it for those who come after us. And I think by the Tarshin phase, they're really into this, and ritual becomes ever more elaborate. And I find it interesting that bodies are broken up and buried collectively to remind you that you are part of a bigger whole. And it was successful because they managed, you know, to carry on like this for a long, long time.
The time scale is sometimes forgotten because we see all the temples now, or what's left of them, all at one time. And one tends to forget that they were built over a long period of time.
Maintained. They didn't just build it and leave it there.
Absolutely. Some of the, perhaps you could talk in the last few minutes that we have, a little bit about the Maltese figurines. I mean, for example, there are the ones that were found at Shara Circle, for example, which have now done the rounds of Europe, I think, which is really wonderful. Ones that we hadn't sort of seen very much so far. the handheld idea.
So I'm really glad you brought that up, because Multa has not only an extraordinary corpus of Neolithic figures compared to other nearby places in Europe, have one of the largest assemblages, but it's also one of the most complex. So when I first saw the Shara figurines, the Shara bundle, there was this thing sort of, oh, look, some of them are incomplete. But then when you look at them, I'm going to give you my story, and perhaps we end with that, how I look at it. I look at them in the context of burial and living. So if we start at a site level, we know that Shara Circle is positioned not just near Gentia, but also Santa Verna and other remains. Equally, if you go to Multa, Hajar-im in Nidra, there's a very archaeologically rich area. People are walking the landscape in a particular way. They can see these buildings and they know their way around. They're also burying collectively, and that burial process takes a long time because they are waiting for the flesh to go away. It's a smelly, sort of quite labor-intensive job. And then you have to go back and you have to disassemble the body, and you have to stack it neatly, skulls in one area, long bones in the other. There's a lot of touching and engagement with the dead. And to do that, you need the cooperation of your community. You need people to keep going back to the site, breaking down the bodies and reassembling them as a whole. And how do you tell people the story of past, present, future, continuity? Well, handheld figurines, you can hold them, you can stick them somewhere in the pot and the dust. You can make up any story that you like. And if you look at that bundle, one way you can read it, and this is what's extraordinary about the prehistory of the Maltese Islands, is they managed to get these complicated concepts of life, death, you know, being somewhere in a liminal zone until your body, the flesh has rotted and we've put it back together. And you can tell the story in so many different ways and move it around. And what better way to keep people together than by telling them the story of who they are, where they came from, and where they're going.
Well, that's a wonderful note to end on. I think that bundle is a really precious thing for us and can tell us so much about people and bodies and the link between the living and the dead as well. And I think you've put that across beautifully. Thank you very much, Dr. Isabel Bella-Gregory, for being with us. And I hope that our listeners will join me again next week, when we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.